Well, we are now going to speak with Lanny Sinkin, who has graced our airwaves before. Lanny, for 5 years, was in charge of, was director of litigation for the Christic Institute, the nonprofit law firm, which is pursuing some of the key people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. He has now left the Christic and is working on a book, and he is now going to join us live from Washington, D.C., to talk about a couple of things which will kick off our discussion concerning the destabilization of the USSR and Eastern Europe, a prelude to World War III. This will begin the third installment of this ongoing archive series. And good evening, Lanny. Are you with us?
I am indeed.
Well, first of all, welcome back once again to the KFJC Airwaves. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's good to be here.
There are a couple of things that you mentioned to me, Lanny, in a talk we had a couple of months ago, or actually one thing in particular, that piqued my interest and frankly scared the expletive deleted out of me. You have developed some information, you have gleaned some information from a number of sources about the possibility of the compromising of a Soviet nuclear device. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, during the early stages of the Middle East War, I was making an effort to perceive what the covert scenarios might be at work within the Middle East that would have prompted this war.
By the way, there was an extensive op-ed column by Lanny Sinkin in the San Jose Mercury News. I don't remember the exact date of that, Lanny, but it people, right around the time that the war began, I think it was either January 12th or 13th, it was on a Monday, no, it was on a Tuesday, there was a huge op-ed column by Lanny outlining some of his views in that regard for people that would like to pursue it in the libraries. Excuse me for jumping in, Daniel. Lanny, go ahead.
That's quite all right. In looking at the situation, I saw one piece I was looking for was I knew that the most likely thing Iraq would do once they were in Kuwait would be to dig in.
Mm-hmm.
And the question would be, would the United States then attack, or if they were going to attack, how would they proceed to attack? I watched as they went to the United Nations. There was always the possibility the United Nations might say no. The Bush administration went to Congress. There was the possibility they might say no. And knowing historically that covert action often involves, the term is false sponsor, you create an event, you attribute it to someone else, and you use that event as the rationale for taking action.
Right.
So I was looking for potential false sponsors, ways that this war could be started that would be blamed on Iraq, when in fact it had been the United States that had set up the event. I knew that there had been significant unrest in the Soviet Union, in various republics, and that there had been reports in the media of unrest in republics where nuclear weapons were on Soviet bases. The newspapers said that the Soviet authorities claimed that no nuclear weapons were in any way in danger, or loss of control was in no way threatened. Then one day I was watching a made-for-television movie, and it was a fictional movie, but at the end of the movie they ran a trailer, and on the trailer it said that in fact in early 1990 in a Soviet republic, a southern Soviet republic, during ethnic unrest, U.S. intelligence sources had picked up information that a Soviet nuclear weapon had been compromised. That was the word used in the trailer, and it didn't say much more. So I applied those various pieces and started thinking about what that might mean. I knew that ever since the Soviet Revolution, we had had a great interest in influencing the Soviet Union and its future. We'd had numerous agents inside the Soviet Union. We had agents outside working with the group known as the Captive Nations Exiles. We'd had a lot of connections with them, and there were a lot of very right-wing fascist groups that were associated with the United States Intelligence Services. I knew that after World War II, Reinhard Gehlen's network had been plugged into the Central Intelligence Agency, so that we had agents throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union that were part of the Nazi network and the old Tsarist network. So we had the capability of both fomenting or exacerbating the unrest in the Soviet Union in order to destabilize the Soviet Union, and perhaps the capability of snatching a nuclear weapon from one of those disrupted republics. And if that was what was going on, my next thought was, well, how would we move that weapon into the theater of war in the Middle East and possibly use it as a false initiator. And I'd reached that point in my speculations and my analysis when the report came out about the 6 Iraqi helicopters defecting. You may remember that one.
Right. That was later denied.
It appeared, and then it was denied. I've read a number of accounts about it. They actually named the airbase. They named the commander. The base was put on alert. They described the helicopters, the type they were. And it said that 6 of them came through. 2 of them dropped into the desert. The other 4 went on to a military base. And all of the fighters that had been scrambled because these helicopters had shown up followed the 4 back to the military base. So it occurred to me that the 2 that dropped into the desert would be a perfect way to plant such a device in the desert and save it in reserves. It was right near the Saudi Arabian-Kuwaiti border, so that if you planted a nuclear device in that area and saved it for detonation later, you could blame it on Saddam Hussein. There had been a great deal of talk by the Bush administration about Saddam Hussein's nuclear capabilities. It was distilled down over the during the course of the war to the possibility that he could construct one crude nuclear device and deliver it by ship or over land, but he didn't have an air capability of delivery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that fit right in with burying something in the desert near the border. So I grew increasingly concerned that we may well have set up such an initiator event. And I wrote both the op-ed that you mentioned that went to various papers around the country and a paper that I delivered to Congress, which included that potential scenario in it, and asked certain members of Congress to see if they could contact William Webster, the head of the CIA, or contact the military commander in the area and find out what those helicopters really were, what the real story was. I never did get any feedback on that. I still think it's a possibility that's what was going on. Of course, the Bush administration got the approval from the UN and got the approval from Congress and proceeded to launch the war without a need for any kind of false initiator.
It may also be that what we were looking at were helicopters used to ferry special forces personnel or commandos inside of Kuwait, and we now know that those special operatives were, in fact, very active inside there. So it may be that what was spotted and perceived as defecting Iraqi helicopters were actually presumably Soviet-made helicopters with Iraqi markings that were being used to transfer commandos for various black ops inside of Kuwait.
Well, my assumption in the scenario was that the 6 helicopters were, in fact, a Delta Force mission,
mm-hmm.
and that when the 4 landed at the airbase, they simply told the commander at the airbase that they were Delta Force and that any knowledge of their mission should be denied.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the story disappeared. There was a great deal of confusion, with Saudi Arabian sources both confirming and denying, U.S. Pentagon sources confirming with lots of detail and then not sure. I think there was enough, something happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And it made sense to me that a Delta Force mission that had to be denied would cause just such confusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, at least to date, we have not seen any sort of Iraqi nuclear terrorist incident, Iraqi here belonging in quotes. One of the things, if in fact that intelligence trailer, and have you learned any more about where they got that landing, or is that sort of a free-floating item at this time?
It's a free-floating item out there. I have to really go back and construct who made that movie and see if I can get back to where they got the report.
It would be interesting. It should also be noted, too, that one of the techniques our national security establishment uses is they will float an impending scenario using fiction, either a movie, a television production, or a book, and use that to direct people's thinking in a particular direction so that when the actual event happens, they go, oh, yeah, that's just like thus and such.
That's right.
I wonder if perhaps that's what we were looking at. One of the things that...
Actually, there's one other element here that I hadn't put in the analysis that occurred to me later.
Mm-hmm.
That if that device was detonated, it might be blamed on Saddam Hussein, but if it was in fact a Soviet device, later analysis might have led to blaming the Soviet Union
right.
providing the device.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is something that occurred to me as well. Another possibility that I think... we should prepare ourselves for or examine is that if, in fact, civil war breaks out in the Soviet Union. By the way, Lanny, I have not had a chance to hear the news today. I've been preparing my broadcast, and I was at work earlier in the day. Have you heard the results of the Soviet referendum? Have they been made public?
No, I've spent the day, I'm working on a book, and I spent the whole day working on it. I haven't heard the news either.
So we both had our noses buried in our travails here. One of the things that occurs to me, and I've been developing a scenario over the past several weeks, that among the motivations for the U.S. adventure into the Middle East, and it should be noted that when our national security establishment decides to move in a particular direction, make a major move, they do so and it'll scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. And one of the things that I think the U.S. per Gulf War represents is not only a psychological warfare device against the Soviet Union. It is reported that the Soviet high command and hardliners are reevaluating their reductions in defense spending because they're concerned that their air defenses may now be vulnerable to U.S. air attack. That obviously would place further strain on the already badly overburdened Soviet economy, which will add to the unrest in the Soviet Union. I also mentioned the Sean Gervaisi article in the current issue, or the most recent issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, in which he talks about the Reagan military buildup and the scary, you know, pro-nuclear war rhetoric as actually a means of scaring the Soviets into trying to match our military buildup, thereby bankrupting themselves. And I think his analysis is right on the money. One of the things that a compromised nuclear device might serve to do would be to further trash the Soviet Union. If, in fact, the Soviets disintegrate into a state of civil war, as some people have predicted, and as you noted, with the legacy of the Galen Organization, the Captive Nations Committee, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, our national security establishment has no shortage of means of projecting forces into the Soviet Union and operating in that regard. It might very well be that a device could be used to do two things. One, further trash the Soviet Union, either eliminate a major city or contaminate a major part of the Soviet Union. This would not only do extreme damage to the country along the lines of what Chernobyl did. And by the way, on the West Coast here, I don't think he's had any exposure in the East. A fellow has appeared on a number of talk shows, primarily on commercial stations, and he has discussed the fact that he sank a ship. I've forgotten his name. He sank a ship, he claims, in the North Atlantic, which was taking out a group of U.S. operatives who had blown up Chernobyl. He actually claimed that the people, he said, had become badly contaminated in blowing up Chernobyl, but that it was feared that because they were badly contaminated and were going to die, that they would blow the whistle on what they had done if they began feeling guilty and decided to make their peace with the Lord before the inevitable happened. So he claims that he was part of a secret team which sank the ship and killed them all before they could possibly spill the beans. So there is actually he's appeared on a number of talk shows, not as a guest, but via phone-in on the West Coast, and obviously, that cannot be confirmed, but I know Mae Brussel, among others, analyzed the Chernobyl event and said this was something that was deliberately induced. Interestingly enough, and this obviously is not conclusive, it's what I like to call food for thought and grounds for further research, but Mama Danilov's baby boy Nick, the journalist who was held by the Soviets in 86, had written an article for U.S. News and World Report shortly before the Chernobyl incident, indicating that Soviet nuclear facilities were far below the safety standards of those in the West and that they could have a nuclear accident. He, incidentally, was the son of an Okhrana officer, the Tsarist secret police. And there was a lot of interesting maneuvering around Danilov. Reagan had said that he would not have any serious arms control agreements. He did not feel that at the summit conference there would be any need for serious arms control negotiations. And all of a sudden, right after the Danilov situation, he hot-footed it to Reykjavik and was hobnobbing with Gorbachev and had some very interesting tentative proposals to begin limiting nuclear arms. I wonder whether perhaps Danilov might be a spy journalist. Interestingly enough, Danilov was the source to which a spurious account, which almost got the House Select Committee on Assassinations taken out of business, the account, I've forgotten exactly what it was offhand, but it resulted in an uproar which almost got the House Select Committee on Assassinations dissolved. That was attributed to him. And and I think it's called Codename Zero, the book by Mark Lane and Dick Gregory, neither of whom I think a whole lot of, talks about that. But I wonder whether perhaps Daniloff was one of these journalist spies which the CIA has utilized over the years, and whether perhaps that U.S. News and World Report scenario may have represented something along the lines of what I fear that television movie might be, namely a foreshadowing of an impending event so that we would see it in the way that we were intended to see it. But I wonder whether we're going to see something along those lines if a Soviet civil war should ensue.
Well, I have two reactions to that. The first is how sad it is that our government, the United States of America, supposedly founded as a democracy with all the high ideals that that concept represents, that people like us, who I think of as loyal to that vision, have come to the point where we would basically attribute any such act to our government because we've seen enough evidence to know that it's happening all the time.
What I would be talking about here would be something like a nuclear lapenka.
Yes. The second thing is, I think if in my analysis of the Middle East war, I projected that what we were trying to do was disrupt Middle East oil supplies in order to make room for the Soviet oil supply. We know that the Soviet Union has drastically reduced production of oil. Many people don't realize that the Soviet export of oil that was going on before the war was primarily Iraqi oil that they were trading for military weapons. So the Soviets would give the Iraqi military weapons, the Iraqis would give them oil, the Soviets would then sell the oil for hard currency on the international market.
That is fascinating, because with the disruption of the Iraqi oil production capability, that would eliminate the Soviets, one of their devices for obtaining badly needed hard currency.
Well, the sanctions cut them off immediately. And when the sanctions went on Iraq from the United Nations, they couldn't sell their oil. The Soviet Union obeyed the sanctions and couldn't get the oil. So right away, the Soviet Union had a tremendous drop in their ability to export oil. The Soviet domestic production capacity is also deteriorated. And there have been a number of reports. The Washington Post on January 31st of this year talked about Soviet oil exports were declining, and the fall in exports was so precipitous that the Soviet Union might even plunge into a debt spiral, according to an official of the Soviet Ministry of External Economic Relations, and that they needed sizable investments, including significant contribution of Western expertise and technology, to prevent the Soviet oil industry's continued decline. On February 10th, they did a follow-up report where they talked about these fields that are being discovered in the Soviet Union, which they referred to as elephants, giant oil fields that pump hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil a day for years and years and years, and they call them elephants, and they were referring to the new oil explorers from the Western multinationals as great white hunters, and that the size of these fields is equivalent to Saudi Arabia, and that with that much oil coming under the wing of United States and other Western multinational corporations, they would need a way of marketing that oil, and they knew full well that if Saddam Hussein was pushed, he was going to destroy the Kuwaiti oil fields. We could destroy the Iraqi oil fields. You take Kuwait and Iraq out of oil production for a significant period of time, and you make room then for the Soviet oil production to come online. I think that was an integral part of the whole scenario in the Middle East war.
I also think that
getting control of the Soviet oil through the multinational corporations was the best way they could see of penetrating the Soviet Union's economic life and getting at all of the resources that the Soviet Union has and putting them at the disposal of the multinationals, that this disruption of Soviet political and economic life, making it almost impossible for the government to deliver goods and services to their people, would force them to turn to the U.S. multinationals. The U.S. multinationals would in turn bring in their economic investment and their technology, but the price would be Soviet resources.
Mm-hmm.
They would go in and develop the Soviet Union. but the Soviet Union's resources would then be at their disposal.
Which is something which Western companies and Western entrepreneurs have undertaken to do even before the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union. This was a major goal of Western entrepreneurs but during the period of the Tsar. We're going to be running short of time here, Lanny, because I have a lot of other things to talk about. So I wanted to run a couple of other things by you in this connection. And by the way, we will be speaking in weeks to come at some length so that we can explore some of your views on the macroeconomic and macro-political aspects of the Middle East war at the length that they really deserve. But tonight, since I'm doing a program specifically about the destabilization of the USSR, I want to focus the discussion for the time being on a couple of other things, because we're going to take our leave here. Again, in weeks to come, I hope to have you on and we can really stretch out at some length and explore this. But if a Soviet nuclear device is compromised, and whether or not it goes off, it could very easily serve as a pretext for, among other things, the continued development of Star Wars. Now, with the alleged success of the Patriot missiles, I guess success, but it remains to be seen whether what we were really told the truth about how effective they were. But George Bush seized on this in order to come up with sort of Son of Star Wars, I guess you could say, or Star Wars 2, a limited Star Wars. And with the instability in the Soviet Union, and there are very serious indications that we are promoting that as hard as we can, that is to say, the U.S. national security establishment, whether or not it goes off, the compromising of a Soviet nuclear weapon could very easily serve as a pretext for continued Star Wars funding, which would be appropriated under the rationale of seeing to it that we have a limited shield so that we can protect against, you know, a Soviet nuclear lone nut, you know, a general or colonel who might decide to fire a missile on his own, or some wild-eyed fanatics who might decide to pull something on their own. What is your opinion of that?
Well, that I think is the kind of uncertainty they'd like to create to justify Star Wars. Of course, the Patriot missile had nothing to do with the Star Wars program. It was developed independent of the Star Wars program, but they've attempted to link the two. And secondly, I think their ultimate objectives in the Soviet Union are either to provoke a new wave of Stalinism, to have the hardliners move in and take over again so they can restore the Cold War and all that it means to them.
Which, by the way, Lanny, is exactly the scenario that I have been developing over the past several weeks. Go ahead.
And the alternative is a disintegration of the Soviet Union into a third world series of countries that would all be dependent on Western technology and investment for their very survival as Europe has become.
Which is the scenario you have been developing here this evening.
Right. And I think, too, Congressman Henry Hyde recently said that with this tremendous success in Iraq, we should push on to continue forcing the Soviet Union down the road we want them to go, making noises about encouraging the separation of various republics and all of that. The hard right wing is determined to dismember the Soviet Union if they can, and that kind of pressure is exactly the kind of pressure that would bring on a Stalinist reaction to prevent disintegration of the Union.
And the Soviet national security establishment, the military and the KGB, have already stated in no uncertain terms that they will not stand by and see the breakup of the Soviet Union.
That's right. That's right, and I think we're at a very critical time now. Boris Yeltsin is playing a very important role that needs to be very carefully watched.
And Boris Yeltsin, by the way, is as testified to in the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, is very heavily involved with some of the same American far-right forces that have boosted Reagan and Bush so successfully.
Well, it's ironic to see Boris Yeltsin talking about democracy. He was one of the most heavy-handed warlords in the Soviet Union under the old regime.
Well, democracy in the twisted political lexicon, the newspeak of the Reagan and Bush administrations, really could be seen as Orwellian newspeak for fascism. Because that's really, when they talk about democracy, and when they talk about freedom, when they talk about people being free, they basically mean they don't want to have to pay them any wages, you know?
Well, that's part of what it means. I also think they have a sophisticated plan of introducing democratic process and then bringing in the computers to control it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we've certainly seen what they think of American democracy, and the work of the Christic Institute, which you were so instrumental in helping to forward, is one of the very few things standing up against martial law scenarios. And I, by the way, just before we had you on the air here, was talking about my fear that among the things Iraqi uranium or perhaps a compromised Soviet nuclear device could be used for is a nuclear provocation in this country, the mother of all provocations, so to speak.
Oh, certainly it would be, yes. And if I might, Dave, for people that are interested in the analysis that you mentioned that was in the San Jose Mercury News, I have a complete paper and a series of papers on the Middle East.
Where can people obtain that, Lanny?
They can write to me. It's LANNYSINKIN. I'm a post office box 29492, Washington, D.C., 20017-9492. For the whole series, a contribution of $10 would be greatly appreciated.
All righty. Why don't you repeat that one more time, Lanny, for the benefit of people that are not taping, although I will also remind listeners that this discussion with Lanny will be on permanent file with archives on audio as part of the archive series about the destabilization of the USSR. But go ahead, Lanny. We have a lot of people who listen casually, and some of them may have been scribbling furiously.
Okay,
why don't you run by once more?
If you had a chance to get a pencil and paper, it's Post Office Box 29492, Washington, D.C., 20017-9492.
Okay. Well, it remains to be seen whether Dr. Jekyll and Henry Hyde scenario is put forward, but it's important and it's terrifying, and we will see. As President Eisenhower said, the future lies ahead.
Indeed, it does.
And sometimes I wish it didn't, because I'm frankly terrified about what the future holds.
Well, I have a great deal of confidence in the people of this country. You know, they can seize our government with a national security apparatus and manipulate our policies and all of that, but they're dealing with a population that has been exposed to the democratic vision. The civics class that we all took, which I think they're probably not offering anymore because look what it did to us, taught us that the government is supposed to serve the people, the power resides in the people, the government's supposed to be responsive to the people. I think the New World Order, trying to impose the New World Order in a country like this, is going to be a very difficult undertaking.
Well, I hope you're right, Lanny. They've been reasonably successful so far, but on the other hand, there are individuals like yourself who have thrown their weight against it, and hopefully with the proliferation of the kind of consciousness which you exemplify, we can stem the tide.
Okay, I hope so.
Okay, well, listen, Lanny, as I said, we're going to move along because I have a lot of material to do on the USSR and Eastern Europe this evening. I will be working on this series at least one more week, possibly two, but within the next several weeks I would like to have you on at some length, and then we can really stretch out and explore these scenarios that you have outlined for us briefly this evening.
It'd be my pleasure.
Okay, well, once again, it's been both a pleasure and an honor to have you gracing the KFJC airwaves, and once again, these airwaves will always be open to you should you want to communicate with this audience.
All right, thank you, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Lanny.
Good night.
Good night now. Alrighty, well, that obviously concludes our discussion with Lanny Sinkin for this evening, and as I said, I will have him back in weeks to come. I'm now going to take a musical break, and this discussion represents the initiation of tonight's archive program, The Destabilization of the USSR in Eastern Europe, A Prelude to World War III, and this is the third installment, music, and then the bulk of tonight's archive show.